This is 2RPH. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James, and you're listening to the Antiques Radio Show, bringing you a monthly kaleidoscope of things old, beautiful, or both, whether valuable or not. We start the show with an alliteration of sales. Items connected to Boris Becker, the Beatles, and a famous pair of boots. And you may detect a theme running through the programme, provenance. Important to collectors, museums, and previous owners of items, or to current claimants. After all, you don't want to buy stolen goods. And if you pay a hefty premium for something that once belonged to a famous person, you want to be certain it really did belong to them. So where something comes from is important, and it might also be significant where you come from. Stay tuned, all will be explained. But first, let's remind ourselves of what the Antique Trade Gazette said about provenance in its list of terminologies, taken from the 6th of July 2019. Provenance. That this term refers to the history of ownership of an object, an item with a long and documented history to a prestigious family or well-known collector, for example, would be said to have good provenance and therefore be more desirable. But let's turn to our alliteration of three items, all depending highly on an attractive provenance to reach their surprising results. And this comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 20th of July. And we start off with Boris Becker. Trophy lots from Boris Becker sale. The auction of sporting memorabilia seized from three-times Wimbledon champion Boris Becker closed on July the 11th, with bids totalling £687,000, well above the expected value of £250,000. The 82-lot timed online-only sale of medals, awards, trophies, rackets, watches and photographs was held on behalf of the trustees in bankruptcy of the estate of Boris Becker in an auction conducted by business asset auctioneer Wiles Hardy & Co. It was hosted on thesaleroom.com, iBidder and BidSpotter. The top lot was a full-size Tiffany silver replica of the US Open trophy that Becker won in 1989. It sold for a hammer price of £150,250. Replicas of the Davis Cup Winners' Trophy and the Renshaw Cup made £52,100 and £40,250, respectively. Originally, the auction had been due to be offered in June last year, but shortly after the bidding had opened, Becker was able to get the sale postponed. Becker was declared bankrupt in June 2017. And that's a sorry, but a successful story as well of the sale of Boris Becker's items. And our second alliterative item, the Beatles' first Epstein contract, and this also comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 20th of July. The Beatles' first management contract with Brian Epstein has sold at Sotheby's for £220,000 plus premium, which incidentally is close to $500,000 Australian dollars. It came for sale by descent from Epstein's publisher. John Winston Lennon, George Harrison, James Paul McCartney and Peter Randolph Best all signed the typescript document on January the 24th, 1962, although Epstein's own signature is conspicuously absent. With no prior experience of music management, he chose not to sign it. The January 1962 contract, estimated at £200,000 to £300,000 in an online sale that closed on July the 9th, was only valid during Pete Best's tenure. With the arrival of Ringo Starr, it became void and a new contract was signed on October the 1st, 1962. This second contract, which was to remain in force until Epstein's death, was sold at Sotheby's in 2015 for a premium inclusive £365,000. Most things these days associated with the Beatles fetches good money, but I think that contract without their name on it probably wouldn't have got very far at all. And our third alliterative item from the same page of the Antique Trade Gazettes, it's all about an old pair of boots. Lions' boots are made for shooting. Celtic legend Tommy Gemmell's boots from the 1967 European Cup final are going under the hammer at a Glasgow auction on July the 19th. The Lisbon Lions were the first British club to win the Cup, beating Inter Milan 2-1 in the final held in the Portuguese capital. Gemmell scored the equaliser in the match. The Adidas boots he wore are estimated at £7,000 to £10,000 in McTeers Sporting Medals and Trophies auction. The auction house says the Adidas boots, previously on display at the Scottish Football Museum at Hampden Park, are being sold by a Glasgow businessman whose father was friends with both Gemmell and fellow Lisbon Lion Bertie Auld. And the BBC.com records that the final price was £18,000, including buyer's premium, which was about $30,000. Quite a lot for an old pair of boots, possibly. But then the price was all in the provenance. Let's turn now to page 3 of the Sydney Morning Herald of the 2nd of August, where we have a large photograph of a gentleman holding a guitar. And the caption is, Dr. Matthew Stevens with the guitar Napoleon possessed while in exile on St. Helena. And this article, written by Nick Bonihady, is entitled The Guitar That Napoleon Did Surrender to a Sydney Socialite. Napoleon Bonaparte, French emperor and military genius, is not generally known for his musical talents. But Museum of Sydney curator Matthew Stevens said there was no doubt a guitar that will go on show next Saturday at the museum belonged to the French leader. Dr. Stevens said Napoleon was given the guitar by his sister and owned it while he was exiled to the tiny island of St. Helena in the Atlantic Ocean after losing the Battle of Waterloo in 1815. Napoleon lived on the property of the Balcombe family, who ran stores for the East India Trading Company on the island. The parents, who spoke little French, wheeled out their 13-year-old daughter Betsy to entertain the 46-year-old, once the most powerful man in Europe. The first question he asked was, I suppose you're too young to play music, and she said, No, 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 I play and I sing, Dr. Stevens said. And Betsy proved it by singing Ye Banks and Ye Braes, a 1791 song about a man who seduces and then abandons a younger woman. Dr. Stevens said Napoleon called it one of the prettiest English songs he had ever heard, but was pleasantly surprised when Betsy told him it was actually Scottish. In Betsy's account, a relieved Napoleon revealed his real view. The English wrote the vilest music in the world, he said. Over the next 3 years, Betsy entertained Napoleon with her singing. It is unclear if Napoleon ever played the guitar to accompany her, if Betsy played it, or if someone else did. But the Balcombe family's friendliness with the exiled leader displeased British authorities, and the family was recalled to England in 1818. The family story has always been that the guitar was given to Betsy when she left, Dr. Stevens said. It's possibly true. Alternatively, Dr. Stevens said the guitar might have been sent later from St. Helena to Australia, where the family moved in 1824. The Balcombe family home, Briars, in the Mornington Peninsula, still holds a large collection of Napoleonic artefacts. Either way, Betsy, by then Mrs. Abel, became a Sydney socialite by dint of her Napoleonic connection. One Sydney newspaper called her the interesting Mrs. Abel, and she danced at parties thrown by Captain John Piper, after whom Point Piper is named. But questions have been raised about the guitar's provenance. I think they mean provenance. In 1917, its sale to raise money for the war effort prompted the Sydney Evening News to write, There is not a word, not a hint from any of Napoleon's biographers that the prisoners of St. Helena was wont to be his own minstrel. Dr. Stevens said, while Napoleon was not that musical himself, he enjoyed hearing others play. The guitar will be part of the Songs of Home exhibition from August the 10th, which celebrates the musical culture of early Sydney. The next item certainly brings the issue of provenance to a head, and we go back to the Antique Trade Gazette of the 20th of July, and this item is written by Alex Capon. Egypt threat of legal action adds to politicisation of antiquities. The Antiquities Dealers Association, ADA, has said dealers and auctioneers should stand up to the politicisation of the antiquities trade in the wake of a row surrounding the sale of a £4 million sculpture. It follows the Egyptian National Committee for Antiquities Repatriation, saying it will instruct a UK law firm to file a case over the auction of a bust of Tutankhamun at Christie's on July the 4th. It called on Interpol to track the statue and other artefacts which it claims have been sold without the correct paperwork. Prior to the sale, Egypt had questioned the legality of trading in these items, the authenticity of documents, and the evidence of legal exportation from Egypt. But Christie's has countered, stating that it carried out extensive due diligence. Chairman of the ADA, Joanna van der Lande, said that Egypt's claim was part of a wider zeitgeist of nations attempting to reclaim works found on the antiquities market. Auction houses have been fielding claims from archaeologically rich countries for decades, she said. With the increased online presence and transparency of both dealers and collectors, they too are now being targeted. In the case of Egypt, they had a thriving antiquities market for over 100 years when they finally made it illegal to export antiquities in 1983. Van der Lande pointed out that a complex sharing system used in the past, where foreign excavation teams worked with government museums to share archaeological finds with no legal obligation to retain invoices and documentation, meant that legally exported antiquities were now becoming unfairly tainted. What is important now is that the market continues to tighten its due diligence practices, which it has been doing in recent years, and that it also stands up to the politicisation of the trade. The latest development follows Turkey's decision to pursue legal action over the $12.5 million, that's $9.7 million UK pounds, sale of the Gwenole Stargazer, an ancient Anatolian idol at Christie's in New York in 2017, and the demand last year from Greece for a Corinthian geometric period bronze horse at Sotheby's be returned. Before the sale of the Tutankhamun head, Christie's published a 50-year collecting history that indicated the piece had been in Germany, probably first in the collection of Prince Wilhelm von Turn-and-Taxis, who lived from 1919 to 2004, since the 1960s. In responding to the legal threat, the auction house issued a statement saying that it clearly carried out extensive due diligence verifying the provenance and legal title, established all required facts of recent ownership. Christie's also questioned why Egypt had not raised doubts about the head when it had been exhibited in the past. It added that it would not and does not sell any work where there isn't clear title of ownership and a thorough understanding of modern provenance. We recognise historic objects can give rise to complex discussions about the past. Our role is to provide a transparent, legitimate marketplace upholding the highest standards for the transfer of objects from one generation of collectors to the next. And I think that underlines the complexity, but also the importance of this wonderful word, provenance. You're listening to the Antiques Radio Show with Jolly and Warwick James on the 2RPH network. We hinted at the beginning of the programme that it wasn't just a question of where items came from and their history, but there was also the question of where you came from and how that might alter your history considerably. And we've now got two stories on that topic. The first is from the 13th of July, the Antique Trade Gazette. And on page 13, there's rather a nice story that you might project yourself into. Surprise new custodian of the Cornish Manor has a clear out. The story of Cornish care worker Jordan Rogers, who proved he was the illegitimate son and legitimate heir to a £50 million Penrose mansion, made national headlines in May. It has also had a knock-on effect in the auctioneering world. The 31-year-old is sorting out some of the treasures of the Porthleven house, the first tranche of which provided 56 items at David Lay's auctions, which carries an 18% buyer's premium, 1780 lot sale in Penzance on June the 20th to 21st. They included a London 1666 silver porringer and cover with the maker's mark WW over a fleur-de-lis and engraved to the rim 1688, IR, HR and HR 1721. The initials represent members of the Rogers family who occupied Penrose House since the late 17th century. With additional repoussé and chase decoration showing a lion and a dog, the Bombay lower body, the 8-inch, that's 20-centimetre, high vessel, deemed in remarkably good condition, took a mid-estimate £2,600. The surprises came among 25 items of early clothing found in the mansion, which generally flew beyond estimates. Among these were a mid-18th century gentleman's blue silk undress cap and early 18th century shoes. The cap, lavishly embroidered with foliate designs and in good condition, was estimated to £100 to £150 and sold for £2,200. The early 18th century fine cream fabric shoes with embroidery of silver thread and spangles and floral motifs were pitched at £1,000 to £1,200 and made £2,400. I wonder if that'll make everybody rush to check their birth certificates. Historically, legitimacy has been just as important. And there's a new book that's been written. But before we go to the book and the article about it, let me just remind you of what the Wallace Collection is. It's a wonderful museum in London, just off Oxford Street, sort of behind Selfridges, which you may know. It's well worth a visit. It's in Manchester Square, and it is the focus of this book that I'm going to read this article about. And the article comes from the Art newspaper of July-August 2019, the 2 months together, because being the summer holidays in England, they have one issue of the Art newspaper covering 2 months. And the book is called The Most Fortunate Man of His Day, Sir Richard Wallace, Connoisseur, Collector and Philanthropist. And it was written by Suzanne Higgett, and it has 428 pages and cost £45. Sir Richard Wallace, 1818 to 1890, must rank among the most enigmatic figures of the 19th century. He's a rags-to-riches story, more the stuff of fiction than fact. Of obscure origin, he was born in London, illegitimate, and named Richard Jackson. He died as the principal heir of the immensely wealthy 4th Marquess of Hertford, whose spectacular art collections were given to the nation in his, not Hertford's, name. It was always been assumed, but also contested, that Wallace, as he became known in 1842, was the natural son of the unmarried peer whom he served as devoted secretary. It was hoped that this biography, commissioned to mark the bicentenary of his birth, would clarify his parentage, the legitimacy of his inheritance, and his decision to move this great collection from Paris to London, and also flesh out the life and personality of the man himself. Suzanne Higgett, a curator at the Wallace Collection, has unearthed much about his extensive philanthropic activities and devotes her last chapter to the ever-overlooked Lady Wallace. Unfortunately, however, the big question remains unanswered and probably unanswerable, although Higgett believes that Wallace was probably not Hertford's child. self-evidently kindly, he was no Thackeray-style adventurer, but neither can he be considered the most fortunate man of his day. He appears a rather sad and isolated figure at the end, seemingly heartbroken at the rift with his only son, who dared to do what he himself had done, take as his mistress and then marry an unsuitable woman. And that review was written by Suzanne Moore. So hightail it down to the Wallace Collection at Manchester Square in London if you want to see some 15th to 19th century fine decorative arts with an important holding of French 18th century paintings, furniture and very notable arms and armour, porcelain and old master paintings and quite a lot of silver too. How things historically were bought and sold is always fascinating. And also, as is the history of auctioneering. And here's something that tells us quite a bit about both. And we go to the Antique Trade Gazette of the 13th of July and an item headed Bidding for Books Way Back in Circa 1700. A rare copy of the earliest known depiction of a book set auction emerged for sale in Gloucestershire on June the 26th. The Stuart-era engraving proved a worthy front cover illustration to the catalogue of the personal collection of the late Martin Wolfe Orski, selling at Dominic Winter for £18,500 plus buyer's premium. Printed round about 1700, the 11x8 inch, that's 28x20 centimetre, engraving titled The Complete Auctioneer depicts a bespectacled gent standing behind his wares with two ladies and two gentlemen beside him. A notice is pinned to a tree announcing a choice collection of books being the library of the late famous unborn doctor are to be put to sale this day at Mr. LGS Auction in the northwest corner of Middle Moorfields. Below the image are eight lines of verse and the name of the London engraver and print seller Sutton Nicholls, 1668-1729. Book auctions were first popular in the Low Countries as early as 1596. The printer Lodwig Elzevier was granted permission to hold them in The Hague, but the earliest surviving English catalogue is much later, conducted at the home of the clergyman Lazarus Seaman in 1676. Although the sale was conducted Dutch style, with a price starting high and falling incrementally until a bidder chose to claim the merchandise, it was the more familiar ascending auction that quickly gained favour. Closer examination of the book on the complete auctioneer's table reveals many bawdy titles of the Restoration era, such as School of Venus, Play of Sodom and Poems by the Earl of Rochester, alongside standard medical works of the period, Aristotle's masterpiece among them, and other titles including Don Quixote, spelt exactly that way, and Halen's Cosmography. The print can be dated with some accuracy. The former owner of the library was a notorious London quack who, claiming to be an eminent doctor of physic, newly come out of Poland, went by the name of the unborn doctor, seventh son of the seventh son. In fact, as the Old Bailey heard on December the 13th, 1699, John Paden was a bigamist and a fraud, whose additional aliases included Thomas Locke and Servando Ponto. It was Paden's public hanging at Moorfields that led to the sale of the complete auctioneer. Only a handful of examples of the print are recorded, with this example, with two short close tears to the margin now repaired, the first listed in auction records. It is not known when Orski, a renowned dealer who died last December, aged 93, had acquired it. Dominic Winter's specialist, Chris Albury, admitted that many gavel-wielding bibliophiles might have been tempted by the estimate of £500 to £800. However, after a bidding battle won by the New York dealer Justin Schiller, he said the South Cerny salesroom itself would be content with a decent facsimile. And that was an interesting piece of history about books and how they were sold. and a history of auctioneering and how it was conducted, and also a little bit about being a quack doctor and the penalties for being caught out. Let's move now from hangings to holidays. And you've made your travel arrangements, and now you've got to do some packing. What do you pack into? And here's something from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 20th of July. Vuitton trunk shifts at £7,200. Pleased as the vendors were to be told by Gloucestershire auctioneer Martin Lambert that a 1920s trunk from their late parents' home could be worth £2,000, they were happier when pre-sale interest in the sale brought a revised estimate of £2,500 to £4,000 at Taylors and Fletcher's auctioneers, which carries 18% buyer's premium. At a time of strong demand for all Louis Vuitton luggage, much of it for conversion into glass-topped coffee tables, the move was understandable. This one was a fine example, both large at 3 feet 4 inches, that's 1.02 metres wide, and stamped with the name and motif of Louis Vuitton to the brass-bound corners, rivets, leather straps and interior. In good, honest condition, showing expected signs of use over the years, when it had been in the same family, it was original down to the 4 cast iron casters. Come sale day on June the 20th at the Boughton-on-the-Water Rooms, online bidders gave way at around the £3,000 marks to bidders on the 7 booked phone lines, one of whom took the trunk, which is pictured, at £7,200. And now from Vuitton to vinyl, from the 20th of July Antique Trade Gazette, Brahms booms in vinyl revival. The resurrection of vinyl continues apace, as was evident when a large collection of classical records offered by Ledbury auction house John Goodwin, 15% buyer's premium, attracted specialist trade and private interest from all over the world. The collection, sold in lots of up to 200 records down to single stars, totaled more than £27,000 when offered at the Three Counties Showgrounds in Malvern on May the 29th and June the 20th. The prize single item came in the June sale, the 1967 recording of Brahms' Violin Concerto by Leonard Kogan. The reserved Ukrainian-born Kogan, 1924 to 1982, was regarded as one of the finest violinists of the 20th century. And this recording for Columbia, with the Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Kirill Kondrashin, is something of a holy grail among the cognoscenti. Estimated at £400 to £600, it sold for £2,200. That's all we have time for today on the Antiques Radio Show. If you have any feedback or issues you'd like to raise, please telephone 9518 8811 or email info@2rph.org.au. I'm Jolyon Warwick James and I work in the antiques industry. I have developed this program as a volunteer, unrelated to my business.